This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.
And there it is. That's as good as it gets on this stage. Nissan Townstar EV strikes again. It's an unstoppable van. Unstoppable!
Look, just fantastic. You can actually see the ProPilot technology in action. Effortless parallel parking.
It moves with all the confidence that comes with a 5-year warranty.
And with a bench full of all-star van experts, there's real strength in depth here.
That's all-star quality.
Search Nissan Townstar EV and visit your local all-star van centre to see for yourself.
Terms and conditions apply. 5 years or 100,000 miles, whichever comes first.
ProPilot is an advanced driver assist technology. Driver's responsibility to stay alert, drive safely, and control vehicle at all times.
The TalkSport Fan Network is proudly supported by McDelivery, bringing you the food you love. McDelivery brings a top-tier lineup of food right to your door. No matter the result, you'll always be winning with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app and you'll get rewards points delivered too, so that ordering today means some tasty rewards for tomorrow. Only via app at participating restaurants. 18 plus rewards registration required. Points only on menu items, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Although we've only got four games left and they've got 5 games left, that's a long way to go yet at this stage of the season.
So it's all to play for still?
I think so. Do you want to bet against us?
When I go home late at night, this is a song that I really like to sing right now, so I'll play it for you. It's called My Old Man.
Williams prepared to adventure down the left. There's a good ball played into Tony Morley. Oh, he missed it!
Welcome to the My Old Man Said podcast. I'm David Michael, the editor of myoldmansaid.com, and this show, episode 60, is a standalone show where I take you back to what most Villa fans will consider as the golden era, where we came out of nowhere in the late 70s to pick up a few League Cups and dent Liverpool's run on winning league titles by winning an unlikely league title after the first time in over 70 years, before going on to win the European Cup in 1982. And the reason why we are looking back to this period is this show is an interview with author Richard Sydenham about his recent book, Ticket to the Moon, Aston Villa, The Rise and Fall of a European Champion. And Richard's spoken to pretty much everybody involved during this period of the late 70s running through to the 80s. The fascinating through line of the book is essentially how do you go from European champions to getting relegated within a just short 5-year period. So in the interview, like the book, we talk about Ron Saunders, Tony Barton, Graham Turner, Billy McNeil, through to Graham Taylor, and all the personalities and players involved during that time. We also talk about the making of the book and how Richard got it together. I mean, he had access to the boardroom notes and memos, etc., which really makes it canon in terms of that period of Aston Villa. And if you haven't read it already, I mean, I'm sure by the end of this podcast, you'll no doubt be interested in buying it, because it's, in terms of Villa reads, there's a few sketchy ones out there, there's a few good ones, and this is definitely in the very good pile. Before we go on, going into the new year, it would be great to actually do more on-location interviews. Obviously, they come with a lot more organisation and costs, travel costs and time. This is one of the things that are only possible due to the My Old Man Said patrons. So if you've been considering becoming a patron, it would be great timing to actually sign up for the new year. For more details, please go to myoldmansaid.com and click on the Patreon option. If you're on a mobile device, it's the square button with three lines, the menu button, and you'll find it on there. We will do the shout out for all the patrons that have signed up in the last couple of weeks on the next proper show, which will be in the new year. So now, onto the interview, which takes place in the plough at the pub in Harburn, if you're not familiar with it, which incidentally, Richard met Gary Shaw and Gary Thompson in there while he was compiling his book by interviewing all the relevant players of the era. So, until next time, enjoy. So, joining me today to talk about his new book, Ticket to the Moon, Aston Villa, The Rise and Fall of a European Champion, is the author of the book, Richard Sydenham.
Thanks for having me.
Not a problem, but just let's take it from the start. You've obviously written a few books, including Kirkley Ambrose's biography, a book about Steve McQueen, and obviously being a Villa fan, is it fourth generation? Or
I'm the third that I know of. My son's the fourth.
So did you ever have the inclination to do a Villa book, or you know, what was the spark to actually... Let's say cement the idea.
Well, I've always been a Villa fan from childhood. Eventually, when I became a journalist in the mid-90s, I was writing on Villa then, as well as cricket. My career took me more towards cricket, but that love and passion for Aston Villa always remained.
Were you covering games?
Yeah, I used to cover games. I worked for a few local papers like the Sunday Mercury and Metro News in the mid-90s when I was a bit of a rookie. I'd cover games in the Dwight York was my first interview. So we'll come back to that one if you want. But I suppose when I'd written a few Villa books, in the Steve McQueen book, as you mentioned, and I enjoy writing books, and I thought, you know what, the more I spoke to guys from that 1982 era, how that European, how you can go from being European champions to relegated 5 years later. I just thought it was a great story.
Yeah.
And the more I looked into it, I saw it was a bit of a rise and fall journey, the way that Doug Ellis and then Ron Saunders came in and picked Villa from the doldrums and won a couple of League Cups, the League, European Cup, and relegation.
Did you meet a lot of the players through, is it Big Star?
Big Star Creations is my company, but I met a lot of the players pre that company, really, when I was more of a football journalist, when I used to do football and cricket journalism together. So I knew a few players, and a few of the players I kind of rang up and got to know in the making of the book. People like Warren Aspinall and Martin Keown I'd never spoken to before, before doing this book, but other guys, particularly from the 81-82 team, I did go back some years with.
Did you try to, off topic a little bit, but did you try to track down Simon Stainrod? I forgot he scored.
Briefly, but I didn't feel his contribution was that important to the book.
But he actually
scored
one season. I was looking through the stats and I was like, fucking hell, when did he score? It was like 20 goals in a season or something.
Yeah, he did have a good season. In fact, I remember, I think, didn't he score four on his debut against Exeter in the League Cup? I think he won 4-0 and he scored all four. I think that was away, and I remember listening to it on the radio. So he was actually a player I liked, but when I started this and looked at all the people I wanted to interview, it was a list of about 60, with obviously people like Doug Ellis, the Saunders family, the Barton family, Steve Stride, the long-serving secretary, Alan Evans, Spinky. These kind of people were high up on the list, and I guess Stainrod would have been on it, but quite a lot lower.
I'm joking about Stainrod, but in terms of initial feeling from those players that you were talking to, and the idea started to crystallise, was there a sense that their story, the real story, hadn't actually been told?
I think they've always felt that they never got the credit they deserved for the League Championship win and the European Cup and then Super Cup, because it was an era when Liverpool were dominating. Obviously, Nottingham Forest had that period, didn't they, when they won the European Cup twice, had some great success. And Cluffy was so quotable, wasn't he, that he was in the media a lot. Ron Saunders wasn't really a great lover of talking a lot to the media. So Villa, and when Ron Saunders left and then the success dipped very quickly after Rotterdam, Villa disappeared a bit in terms of the national media coverage.
Just to backtrack,
I think all the players are quite glad this story has been told.
So just to backtrack a little bit, what I learned from the book, which I didn't know, was actually Brian Clough was approached by Doug Ellis. I think that was just before they went with Saunders, wasn't it? And they had a meeting and quickly realised it was never going to happen.
Never going to happen, not with those egos, Doug and Brian Clough, no. In fact, the first consideration for that surprised Doug. They went to sign John Robson, the old left back, in I think it was 1972, And they went to the old baseball ground, and while Vic Crowe was speaking to the player, John Robson,
yeah.
Cluffy and his sidekick Peter Taylor turned on Doug and the secretary Alan Bennett and said, "Would you ever consider us as managing Villa?" Which, obviously, when they were there to sign a player, they didn't see that one coming. Vic yeah. Crowe was already in the job doing okay, so
yeah.
it was kind of dismissed pretty quickly. But then when Vic Crowe was sacked in 1974, they did consider Cluffy, and Doug went and met him in a restaurant in Lichfield. But like you said, that I think Doug realised pretty quickly that the size of Cluffy's ego was never going to go along with his own, and it was never really taken much further than that. Obviously, Ron Saunders was also a strong-minded guy, but he was happy to take much lower profile.
Yeah, I think that was there was plenty of room up front for Ellis to kind of posture.
That's right.
And that was, I think that's like the biggest difference between Saunders and Clough in the end. But it's, when you look at Villa's history, I don't know, even 90s, there's a lot of what ifs.
Mm.
What if we had signed these players? And a lot of the reason why Saunders left is, I read that bit about the North Stand and the... Was it Terry Rutter and Harry Marsden?
Yeah, it gets quite political and deep in the end, but I think the best way to crystallise it is the fact that Ron Saunders was... He was not your typical football manager who just wanted to, you know, buy players and worry about his team. He cared deeply about the whole football club. He wanted to know what was going on throughout, which is something that Doug Ellis always never liked when he was chairman. Obviously, Doug wasn't there for that three-year period from 79 to 82, but that was typical Ron. He felt there was a lot of money coming into Villa at that stage, and he thought, well, we've got all this money coming in, why am I not getting my hands on any of it to buy players?
Because ultimately they were getting to a point where they were being as successful as a team could be, so there's got to be money there. It's logical.
There was a quote from Tony Morley saying that we've won the league or the European Cup, why aren't we going to try and sign players like Brian Robson and Ray Wilkins? I mean, realistically, Robson was never going to leave Man United after signing for them for over £1 million from West Brom a year earlier. But I actually interviewed dear old Ray Wilkins just about a month before he died, actually.
Oh, right.
Lovely guy.
Yeah.
And he spoke about why he wouldn't have gone to Villa at that stage, because he saw what United were building, what it eventually became. Obviously, won the FA Cup with them in 83 with that great goal. But he spoke about how Villa didn't build for the future like Man United did. And eventually that's what happened with the relegation.
United were also interested in Ron Saunders, weren't they, at one stage?
I believe Martin Edwards spoke to him about it, and even Ron could have had the England job after Ron Greenwood as well. But, I mean, these...
This is what's really frustrating. Here you've got a manager, that, arguably the best manager Villa have ever had, who has the interests of the club at heart to such an extent. He tells England to get lost, he tells Manchester United to get lost, and then the end game is so...
There's a lot of unfulfilled promise there. I mean,
but there's a saying that nowadays a lot of Villa fans say, and that's typically Villa, and that is typically Villa. When the golden goose is in sight, we always turn our back.
Don't go the extra mile. That's right. But Ron Saunders, this is fact, he wanted to finish his managerial career at Villa.
Yeah.
It's a shame in the end that a great manager like him ended up going to Birmingham City. He had a couple of good seasons there with a couple of bad ones, and then obviously had a bad time at West Brom, where he retired and totally, you know, didn't want to know football after that. It could have ended so much different if they'd have maybe backed him a bit more. He wanted to strengthen that team when they won the league. He really wanted to strengthen that. I mean, we all know they did that with 14 players, which was incredible. And when that squad got tested with injuries in 1981-82, yes, they won the European Cup, but even Gordon Cowans told me there was clearly some prioritising going on there, whereby they thought, well, we've won the league, we've never been in the European Cup before, we might never be in it again, and they put everything into the European Cup to the point where they won it. But look where they finished in the league. I think it was 11th.
Because I think I remember reading in the book where it suggests that the board actually thought, well, if you can win the league with 14 players, then you can obviously, you don't need many more. So that's why they excuse for not spending.
Yeah, and that was naive thinking from a guy, Ronald Bendel, who he was not really a football man. he was a businessman, and then that decision really was a typical businessman who, if they could not spend money, then they'd rather not. But the fact is that their one signing after winning the league was Andy Blair.
Yeah.
And not knocking Andy, he's a nice guy and he was a good player, a good young player at that stage, who they picked up from Coventry for not very much money. But surely when you're English champions, you've knocked Nottingham Forest and Liverpool off their perch, and you've gone to the final hurdle with Ipswich and all their stars, and you've won, surely you'd strengthen a bit more and bring in some more players.
He wasn't allowed to do that. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the process of actually putting the book together. And to tell the story, you obviously have two obstacles straight away. One is Ron Saunders is obviously suffering deep with Alzheimer's, and obviously Tony Barton is no longer with us. Did you see that as an obstacle? And ultimately, how, let's say, clear was the info that you got from the family, and, you know, how were they in terms of getting what you wanted to fulfil the book?
Yeah, well, first of all, if I take the Tony Barton's case, obviously he passed away in the 1990s, so his role in Villa from the time he came into the club as a scout in the 70s through to when he was sacked as manager in 1984, his memories were integral to the story, really, particularly that European Cup run and after, the way some of the players left. And I was really pleased that his son Chris and his wife Rose invited me round their house, and I spent a whole Sunday afternoon with them, and they were really honest and transparent with what happened and what Tony had been through, and talked about his plans for Villa and some of his experiences. And so that really opened my eyes and helped me tell the story in terms of his role. As regards to Ron Saunders, I agonised for a long time whether I should even approach them. One, because I knew I'd got no chance with Ron, because he never really speaks to the media.
Yeah.
And two, I thought, will his family really want to help me? Because there's a lot of things that are not very nice said about his dad in the book, because while he was a great manager and possibly one of the greatest ever motivators of footballers and psychologists, he was also accused of being a bit of a bully with some players.
Some players actually say in the book that it wouldn't work now, wouldn't be allowed.
But just to finish that point though, fortunately Ron's son contacted me and saw what I was trying to do and realised that by helping me the story is going to be a lot more accurate with their cooperation than not. So we had many conversations, and I think that's a good point you make there. I think with that accessibility to the Saunders and Barton families, the story is a lot more authentic.
Well, some would say it's essential to give it the stamp of authenticity.
Well, I mean, there's so many themes in the whole book covered from a 20-year period from 68 to 88, but the one memory or one period that I was really keen to get to the bottom of was how Ron Saunders left, and I'm proud and pleased that I was able to, I think, tell that story better than anywhere else.
Was that a process where at any stage you were like, I still haven't got enough in terms of being happy with the resolution that you're putting in the book? I mean, was there any loose ends that you had to go and kind of find somewhere else or basically back up what had been said?
Not really. I mean, there's always another player you could have spoken to or another manager, but I think over, it took me about 4 years to put this together on and off with other things going on in my life, and I think over that period I was very thorough. There's probably about 80 interviewees contributing to the book, so I tried to cover all bases, really, from the dressing room to the boardroom, the secretaries. I even spoke to managers of other teams when signing players from Villa or selling them to Villa. There's a chapter in there on how Andy Gray came to leave Villa to go to Wolves, and I went and met John Barnwell in a coffee shop in Nottingham where he lives now, and he told me chapter and verse on how he signed Gray. And I spoke to Gordon Lee about how he signed Gidman, and Gordon Milne on selling Dennis Mortimer and buying Ray Graydon and Bobby McDonald. So I tried to cover every base, really.
What stage of the process did access to basically boardroom notes arise? Because that was, I mean, I've spoken to a few people who said, why would a club open the door to that kind of information? because that's quite unusual to get kind of almost like carte blanche access to records, transfer fees and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Well, first,
which, I mean, it's happy days for you.
Well, the readers are the winners at the end of the day because the story is more authentic and a lot more honest and transparent than I should imagine anyone has ever written before because of that. But I would admit I probably got a bit lucky. I wrote to the club asking for a chance to come and research that period, and they opened their doors to me towards the, near the start of this process, the writing process, and it was probably at a time when Villa were more interested in, you know, the disarray of the club, really, when, during the Tom Fox era, when they didn't know what was going on, and on the playing side wasn't great. And in that time, I suppose I slipped through the back door. And
I was going to say, you're probably the only person to benefit from Tom Fox.
Exactly. So but I was shown into this, like a broom cupboard kind of room, really, and I had access to all these folders and books, and all just getting dusty, really. And
was there a fucking hell kind of moment?
I think so, but not instantly. It was only when I started realising the boardroom meetings had manager's notes in, and they was talking about players they wanted to sell or players they wanted to buy, and transfer fees, wages, what they were paying players, what bonuses they were giving out, and there's details in there you would never otherwise have known.
Yeah.
But the way I would look at it is, I mean, it's a typical reaction there for a club or even someone who's worked at a club to say, oh, why would they have opened up that kind of information to this author?
Yeah, but
the way I would look at it is, even if I was the new management at Villa now, I would say, well, I'm glad they did that, because this is possibly the most successful period in Villa's history. And the fans deserve to know what really went on, and now they do.
Yeah.
Because what's the point in having all these boardroom records and files and contracts and everything if they're just locked up getting dusty in a cupboard for forever and a day? You know, and, surely they deserve to come out and tell a story at some point.
And the Villa store may burn down one day a freak accident.
It happens,
so
I'm sure.
What was the most amazing thing to you personally that you found in those boardroom notes?
There was a few things. One story saying that in late 1978, Ron Saunders came into a boardroom and said that I've heard Trevor Francis is available. He was a guy who always seemed to score against Villa.
Yeah.
He was an England player by then, so he was a big name. He was a terrace hero at St Andrews. And it amazed me that Villa or Ron, who've never really liked stars or big names, he'd prefer to find them in a lower league and build them up. It amazed me that he actually considered buying Trevor Francis, and he was encouraging the board to back him on that. But while they didn't say no, they reminded him that there was quite a large overdraft, and said, well, they pretty much said, well, you know, we can consider him, but you need to sell before you can buy. I think we've heard that before at Villa, haven't we?
Yeah.
So,
what period was that? What year was that?
That was late 1978, but Francis actually left a few months later. That was when he went to Forest for £1 million.
Oh, that was the first £1 million.
So it was
transfer.
Definitely an authentic story that he was on his way out.
Yeah.
But Villa just wasn't in a position to buy. If it had been a year later, maybe that would have been different, because they sold Andy Gray for 1.5, but at that stage, you just couldn't afford it.
What was the story in the book towards the end of Ron Saunders? We'll go back to the actual making of the book in a second, but the story that Villa had employed a private detective to follow Ron Saunders around?
Yeah, I wouldn't want to go too much into that, because it's like giving the crown jewels to the book away, really. But I think
that's a fascinating
story.
True,
and that came from the Saunders family. But I think it just showed that how much Villa, or probably the boardroom at that stage, or possibly more Ronald Bendel himself, just didn't like what Doug Ellis used to call him sticking his nose into club business.
Yeah.
That was just typical Ron, who wasn't just interested in matters going on the field. He wanted to know what money's coming in and where's it going.
Yeah.
And there was a feeling that we need to get this manager out, and they effectively, just before his resignation, they effectively put him on 3 years' notice, which ended his three-year rolling contract in advance. It was probably what we would call nowadays constructive dismissal.
Yeah.
But now at the time, there was none of that.
You're getting into realms of like Damned United, where you could have a story, a book just on that incident.
Definitely,
if you could flesh it
that
out.
That was fascinating. That, but like I say, they didn't like Run's concerns for areas that was away from the training ground, let's say, and that was some of the things that went on then.
Sorry, going back to the, who was the first person interviewed for the book?
Well, that's a good question. I probably wouldn't remember exactly the first.
Was it an interview for the book, or was it just an interview that actually proved to be useful for a book?
One of the early interviews would be Steve Stride. We went and met in a coffee shop in Birmingham City Centre, because I knew that Steve had been at the club from, I think, 1972 up to way past the period I was writing on. So he's seen everything that I'm talking about. And what I could say on Steve is, before I emailed it all, the whole manuscript into my publisher, I actually emailed every chapter to Steve, because I valued his opinion so much, because I thought, well
it's good, good that somebody does.
Exactly. I thought, well, if there's someone can tell me I've got some part of this book wrong, it'll be Steve, and fortunately he really enjoyed it, so that meant a lot to me.
Because that's one of the mysteries of certainly like recent regimes of Aston Villa, from, let's say, Randy Lerner onwards, is why in so many circumstances where they had a bit of a skeleton staff at the top level, it was like Paul Faulkner or just Tom Fox, without much infrastructure around them, footballing infrastructure, that nobody ever picked up the phone to Steve Stride just for even advice or to run things by him.
It was Mr. Villa for a long time, wasn't he? He's badly missed, I'm sure that. I don't even know the regime there anymore. I'm not that directly linked to Villa like I was with other things gone by. But Steve, when you talk to players, managers, even secretaries from other clubs, no one's got a bad word to say about Steve. He was an ultimate professional, so I was really grateful to have his input in terms of his opinions on what I was writing.
Tracing back my own childhood, obviously, when it comes to the 80s team, everybody talks about Gary Shaw, Tony Morley, Peter Withe, Dennis Mortimer. But I used to play centre-back at my school team when I was like...
You got the hype for it.
We're talking like, you know, under 11s or whatever when it started. And one of the things I learnt off Alan Evans was, and I don't know if this was something he did on purpose, was if he was under pressure, he would always head the ball over his own bar to like get it out of there. And I used to replicate that, but my teammates would be like, what the fuck are you doing? Yeah. But I was totally doing it because I'd watched Alan Evans do it. And the only thing I knew about Alan Evans was he was a driving instructor in Cornwall somewhere. So it was great that you actually tracked him down. I mean, how was he? Because apparently he was quite... did you have like a dinner with him?
Yeah,
he was very lucid.
My mother-in-law actually lives in Cornwall, so it was a good excuse to get away for a few hours.
Right.
I know she won't listen to this, but now I thought, well, it's a long way to go otherwise, isn't it? So I'll slip away for an hour. I arranged to go and have a dinner with Alan at a lovely golf club called St. Melian Resort. He was practicing on the putting green when I turned up late again. So so we had dinner there, and we put the tape recorder on, and we probably did 3 or 4 hours together. I learned straight away. I didn't realise he'd been teetotal for nearly all throughout his career.
Wow, yeah.
So he taught me a new summer drink that I didn't know, which was ginger ale and lime on a load of ice. I drink that now
because
and again if
I mean,
I'm driving.
His persona, I mean, his nickname was Psycho, but also he was like a hard man, which back in those days especially, you'd relate to like drinking and like you know, that kind of culture. What did he give you specifically that maybe like some of the others didn't?
I'll tell you what was really interesting from Alan. I mean, we're focusing here a lot on the league and European Cup team, which is fair enough because that's probably the moon in terms
because
of the,
title. Because he stretches to the promotion
team.
Like
you say,
as well.
he stretched from 77 all the way through to the relegation and then the promotion back under Graham Taylor. And what I found fascinating was two parts in particular. One was how bad things was under Billy McNeil in the relegation season, which I'll come to in a minute. But then the other side of the coin, how good things were under Graham Taylor when he came in. And he actually said, even though he'd been at the club 10 years by then, he learned more under Graham Taylor, and particularly his number two, Steve Harrison, about defending he'd ever learned before in the whole 10 years.
Because in terms of, I mean, the reason, one of the reasons I mention Alan Evans is obviously, as we just said, he's one of the only people that got to stick around. I mean, Gordon Cowan's obviously went but then came back. So we obviously saw the full arc of what the book is essentially about.
In fact, he said it took him days to recover from that relegation. He said he was properly depressed by it, and that's how much it meant to him. But the other part to his interview that was fascinating, the Billy McNeil part, was just how disinterested in the job Billy McNeil was. I mean, he left Man City to come to Villa. And
Manchester City got relegated.
Yeah, he relegated two teams in the same season.
But he came in, I'm trying to remember when exactly, did he come in before Christmas? Or?
He came in October. The end of September, just after Graham Turner got sacked.
Because he had enough time to turn it around.
He had a good run at it. And when you look at the players in that squad, he should never have been relegated. When you go through the team, people like Spink, Mark Walters, Tony DiRigo, Alan Evans, Andy Graves, experienced, Steve Hodge, Steve Hunt was an England player by then. And I'm missing Keown, as I mentioned. There's a lot of really good players in that team.
I mean, a lot of them were quite young. Like
that was Keown the one issue. That was the
Keown
one issue.
DiRigo as well.
Keown and DiRigo were two of the guys that probably deserved to be in the team, despite their age. But
if they stuck around, you could have sold them on.
There was far too many other players coming in. People like David Norton, Dean Glover, Ray Walker, Bernie Gallagher. There's a kid called Phil Robinson. It was just too much. It was too much youth, and that's where I blame Doug Constant focusing too much on kids.
When you look at the age of the team that won the league in 81, like Shaw was like 19, but there was a balance there.
Gary Williams was young. Gibson, Williams, Shaw, people like that, but you also had the experience of Jimmy Rimmer, Peter With, Dennis Mortimer. Des Bremner had been around in Scotland, in Hibernian. Even Tony Morley, who always got associated with the kids, even he'd been around for a good 7 or 8 years by then.
So what's your without obviously giving away too much from the book, did why Villa got relegated, that 5-year drop, did that become a more fascinating than the actual rise to win the European Cup?
I think it goes hand in hand. It's all part of the journey. But what was interesting for me, I was really pleased to get an exclusive interview with Graham Turner.
Yeah.
We had a good chat on the phone for about 40 minutes. And
he's like a forgotten man in the whole story.
He was there for 2 years, and it's incredible that he came to Villa 2 years after they won the European Cup as a player manager from Shrewsbury Town.
He was 36.
So I was really pleased to get his interview and just talk about how difficult it was to go into that. It was a very tight-knit dressing room for him to go and then tell people like Dennis Mortimer and Peter With how to play football. You know, that was tough for him. But not only that, he told me about the players that they were interested in. You know, that he, to be fair to him, he brought in some good players like Keown and Steve Hodge. My one big criticism with that era was that while they would make good signings like Hodge, Barton bought McMahon, but he was there when Turner came in. They would seem to sign a good player on one hand, but sell on the other. And I think it's been like that probably throughout our lifetimes, where you almost feel like you're getting somewhere, and then you'll sell a best player.
Yeah.
And when you keep selling, you can never really, you know, get up there, can you?
And there it is, that's as good as it gets on this stage. Nissan Townstar EV strikes again. It's an unstoppable van, unstoppable!
Look, just fantastic. You can actually see the ProPilot technology in action. Effortless parallel parking.
It moves with all the confidence that comes with a 5-year warranty.
And with a bench full of all-star van experts, there's real strength in depth here.
That's all-star quality.
Search Nissan Townstar EV and visit your local all-star van centre to see for yourself.
Terms and conditions apply. 5 years or 100,000 miles, whichever comes first.
ProPilot is an advanced driver assist technology. Driver's responsibility to stay alert, drive safely, and control vehicle at all times.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Picture the scene. All of your mates around, you've got your McNugget share boxes ready to go. Partner this with your team playing champagne football. Perfect. Order McDelivery now on the McDonald's app. There's nothing quite like a McDelivery. At participating restaurants, 18 plus, serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Talked about Ellen Evans saying that Billy McNeil didn't have any vision or idea. Did Graham Turner come across that he was confident in himself and in the position he was? Because there have been, I'm guilty of it myself, is drawing parallels with like Dean Smith coming in with his Brentford CV, shall we say, and when Graham Turner came in, all he had was Shrewsbury, essentially. But Dean Smith has, let's say, a clean way of playing, a clear way, not a clean way. And you hope it's going to transfer on a bigger canvas with Villa. But Graham Turner was kind of, nobody expected that.
It's an interesting parallel. What I remember speaking to Mervyn Day, who was a goalkeeper for a couple of seasons in those days, and he said that one of the big mistakes Turner made was he would come along in a training session, he would say, right lads, this is what we're going to do, this is what we used to do at Shrewsbury. And people like Dennis Mortar and Peter With, you know, just won the European Cup, won a league, they're looking at each other saying, we don't really care what you did at Shrewsbury, we're Aston Villa. So, but I don't think Dean Smith would make that mistake and say, right lads, this is what we do at Brentford, because number one, Villa aren't that great now where Villa were in the 80s. And number two, Dean Smith is probably 10 years older now than Graham Turner was then, so he's a lot more experienced to handle those situations.
That's the biggest shock of the Graham Turner. I remembered him as a, let's say, a highly regarded young manager, but when you say young manager, you're thinking mid-40s, but actually he was only 36, which you think, what was Doug Ellis doing?
Well, what was also interesting, another revelation in the book, I came to find out, was that he wasn't the first choice, he was about the seventh choice. Mm. Which that only came out from me talking to lots of different people.
Was that with the choices like David Pleat? Was that one?
Yes, Pleat was offered the job. When Doug was in hospital once, he offered David Pleat the job. He was doing a good job, wasn't he, at Luton at the time?
Yeah, they were great.
But he turned that down for a couple of reasons. He felt he was doing good things with Luton, with the likes of Ricky Hill and Brian Steen and those guys. Yeah. But he also felt that when he was offered the job, Tony Barton was still in the role at Villa, and he thought, well, number one, I know Tony Barton and I don't want to take his job while he's still got it. And number two, I'm quite happy at Luton, thank you very much. And he said, I'll wait for a really big club, which, you know, a lot of us Villa fans might like to think, well, wasn't Villa a big enough club for you to come from Luton?
But he went to Spurs.
It just showed you the dip already that had gone on there.
I'm sorry, but Spurs at that time, well, they were early 80s, they were like the FA Cup
team, they won
basically
a couple of FA Cups, but they still hadn't won what Villa had won, which is a good point, actually. The fact the way Pleat saw Tottenham is a bigger move than Villa.
Yeah.
And Tottenham still now haven't won the league since 1961. They've never won the European Cup yet.
Never will.
David Pleat, yes, maybe. But still, David Pleat looked at Tottenham as being a bigger move for him than Villa, which shows you how quickly Villa had dropped.
But I remember in the, especially as a young kid, I mean, obviously, he didn't have the internet back in those days, but the overriding thing would be when it came down to transfers, like Birmingham wasn't an exciting enough place for like players, like today even, wanted to stay in either London or even Manchester and Liverpool were seen as... I mean, that's the thing, when you listen to that argument and people didn't want to move to Birmingham, well, they moved to Liverpool, and you know, there's not that much
difference. I think that argument's overrated myself. I think a lot of it was probably started by London media, who, I mean, it used to show up more with England football team selections, didn't it, when they used to speculate on squad. Most of these newspapers were based in London, and Arsenal, Tottenham players would always get favour over a club
like
Villa.
Because you look at that 1982 World Cup squad, and you just look at... Nowadays, Gary Shaw would have been in that squad, no problem. Tony Morley, no problem.
Yeah. Well, I touch on that quite a lot in the book about how Villa are European Cup winners, yet only Peter With was in the 1982 World Cup squad. Tony Morley was there on Top of the Pop singing the World Cup song, but he didn't even make the final party.
And when you're looking at what actually England needed in those... it used to be the second round then when they played Spain and Germany. They needed some spark, and Gary Shaw and Tony Morley were like right up for that job.
Yeah, well, I think they drew 0-0 twice, didn't they? But I don't think there was a better attacking player than Tony Morley in Europe at that stage. But
like you said, maybe that had a bit to do with that London bias against the Midlands. And not only that, Ron Saunders, in his time, was so dedicated to keeping his players fit and playing for Aston Villa that if Ron Greenwood would ring up saying, I want to take Withy or Tony Morley in my squad next week, Ron Saunders would say, oh, he can't come, he's got a hamstring. And then he'd say to Tony Morley, you've got a hamstring, haven't you? You can't go train with England. He'd say, no, Gaffer, I'm fit.
Yeah.
No, you've got a hamstring. He wanted his players to forego international careers to play for Villa, but the bigger players, would like Morley, would say, well, Gaffer, I want to go and play for my country, and he did.
In that period, even like Ron Atkinson turned down the England job, Ron Saunders wasn't interested in it, but players, it still meant something to players, big time. It's not like, I mean, let's say recently there's a bit more pride in it, but there was a period of like 10 years where people avoided playing for their national team.
Yeah, so that probably has a lot to do with money over the years, doesn't it, where the big money's and the glory and the prestige is more with like playing in the Premier League and the Champions League, unfortunately, and they don't really get any money out of playing for England. Money shouldn't come into it, of course, we all know that, but I'm sure it probably does. But like you say, back then, wearing the Three Lions, I think probably, whether it meant more to players then or now, I don't know, but it certainly meant a lot to those Villa players.
In terms of, you said you had a list of, let's say, 60 at the start. Was there anybody you didn't get for whatever reason?
There's a few I couldn't get hold of in the end. There wasn't many, though. I remember John Gregory, Alan Kirbishley were a couple of guys I couldn't get hold of, whether it was giving me the wrong number or just phoning at the times when they were out the country.
Because Gregory's in India.
He was in India, of course, Alex Cropley I couldn't get hold of, but funnily enough, I actually met him this year when it was too late. But but pretty much most people who I wanted to speak to, the key people, and a lot of the players that I managed to sit down with. So that was, there's no regrets on anyone I didn't really speak to.
And when it came to having access to like the boardroom, was there anything that was kind of off limits?
No, not at all.
Or anything sensitive that you actually made a decision not to
nothing to do with the minutes or the documents. There's one or two interviews when I thought maybe someone's saying something about a player, and I thought, well, it's probably a bit personal and that doesn't really need to go, and you don't need to humiliate anyone. I won't mention names. So that's just...
You can on this podcast.
that's just journalism instincts, just knowing what's relevant. What you can tell a good, interesting, funny story without slaughtering someone sometimes. Yeah. So that you get decisions like that. The one thing I asked for at Villa, which they couldn't bring to me, were the manager's memos. Doug Ellis apparently loved his memos. He'd love to send managers' memos. Things like, we need to do this, that or the other, or keep wages down or whatever it was. I mean, a lot of this stuff gets covered in boardroom meetings anyway, but apparently Doug loved his memos, and I did ask for a file of these memos, but that never came forward. Whether they're still around, I don't know, but I think I'm still pretty happy with what I get in the end.
There's another book, Doug's memos.
Definitely.
You interviewed Ron Atkinson. Yes. You know, I mean, I interviewed him for this podcast. What was his input like, and how long did you get?
I rang Ron up, and there was a few themes I wanted to talk about there. Number one, I have a whole chapter on Ron Saunders, and not only when he came to Villa, I think it was important that the readers knew just what made Ron Saunders tick and his background before he came to Villa. And I was interested to learn that Ron Atkinson was a player for Ron Saunders at Oxford. So he kind of, because it was interesting to draw a parallel between Ron Saunders' style back then, and I also interviewed Dave Stringer when he was at Norwich under Ron Saunders, so I wanted to kind of build a picture of how Ron Saunders' management changed from his early days to when he was at Villa. And I interviewed people like Tony Buck at Man City. So he was able to get a picture of how his management evolved over the years. But Ron Atkinson also, I wanted to know, he bought John Dean off the Villa, so I wanted to know about that transfer. He also told me about the times he turned down the job after Tony Barton left. And also, I've got a chapter on the Midlands rivalry in the late 70s, because I thought it was relevant that although Villa won the league and the European Cup in 81-82,
probably a year or two earlier, there wasn't even number one in the Midlands, never mind Europe, because Notts Forest were on top. So, and Ron Atkinson's West Brom were doing really well.
Because back in the day of, I think it was like Shoot magazines and Match annuals, they would have like Pride of the Midlands and the league tables and the games they'd won, and like they'd compare and contrast the two. So the Midlands rivalry was actually a national concern. Like nowadays, obviously, it's Manchester United, Liverpool and Everton or whatever.
It was interesting. When I spoke to John Barnwell, the Wolves manager from that time, and Gordon Milne, who was Coventry manager at that time, it was interesting that they both felt, outside of Forest, West Brom were the best team. They felt West Brom were more, you know, enterprising and more attacking, and that, and just generally the team they feared more. But they all have full respect for what Ron managed to do with Villa in the end.
Sorry, just picking up the Alan Evans thing, is he living a life completely out of football and has nothing to do with it? Or
I think he does a bit of coaching at a college down there, but like you said, he lives in Cornwall near to Plymouth now, so he's got his driving school.
Saltash,
he's got his own driving there, school, and loves his golf still. He had the horrible heartache of losing his daughter, which wasn't very nice for him, of course. So he's been through a lot, Alan, but a lovely guy, possibly the most honest, transparent interview in the whole book. Great interviewee, very grateful for his honesty. But he still loves the game, you know. I think he comes up to watch Villa now and again when they invite him as one of the old ex-players, so he still enjoys the game.
And Peter Withe and Gary Shaw, were they a big part of the book?
Not really Withy, because he was doing his own book at the time, and I knew that that would be his focus. But I did check a few facts with him at the end, because there was a few things said in the boardroom minutes about his contracts, and so he was able to clarify that.
Was there actually any conjecture between two players' accounts? Because if there's an accident outside and there's five witnesses, they'll give a different account of it.
Not really. Once you get told something by one person, you can check it with someone else, and generally it all added up. I mean, I'll give you an example there. There's two examples. One person told me that John Gidman and Dennis Mortimer really didn't get on, and once you start talking to people like that, you find it was a bit deeper than that. And around that 1979 time, there was actually, people go as far to say, it was a little bit of a splinter group in the dressing room. You know, and even Andy Gray told me that certain players, like including himself and John Gidman, felt Dennis Mortimer was taking too much team talk into the manager's office.
Right.
And that created a bit of an atmosphere, and that's why I think
Gidman didn't like Saunders.
No, he didn't. Yeah. And that's why I think Ron had that clear out in 79 when he sold Gidman, he sold Gray, Gregory went. Brian Little was going to go to the Blues, and he didn't in the end, but he finished not long after. So I think Ron, he was well aware of all this kind of, whether you call it disharmony or what, certain players says they wasn't aware of it because they wouldn't involve themselves in that kind of thing. But there's no doubt there was a bit of an atmosphere between some players. But it's amazing that 2 years later they've won the league, so clearly Ron knew what he was doing and the characters he wanted to bring together.
It's funny when you I think there's a bit in the book where I think maybe one of the players lays out how Ron Saunders plays, when there's like this high press and get that ball back as quickly as possible, and it's basically Pep Guardiola and today's philosophy and what Dean Smith is doing as well.
Yeah, I think it was Des Bremner that said that, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And it's a good point, actually. And I still actually think you could take that, the team and the style of play that Saunders played back then, and you could compare it to today, in terms of being the role model of a team.
What I read in the book, the way you would take training and basically as a unit, the defence and midfield, he would focus on that and tell the strikers to bugger off and just practice finishing, almost as if they were a separate unit.
That's right. And Brian Little said he actually, although he didn't get on with Ron, he says he learnt so much from him, and he used a lot of his training techniques in his own management career. That point you've just made there. So a regular training exercise at Bodymore would be Jimmy Rimmer, the usual back four, the three in the midfield. So eight would take on maybe 11 of the reserves or the youth team.
So they would be like three men short, just to test them really, of working together as a tighter, more organised unit in defence and midfield. And the strikers would go off and, like you're saying, maybe have shooting practice against the other goalkeepers. So things like that, Ron, you know, it was quite inventive.
Because they're known as like a hard working team, but when you looked at the highlights, when you, like Gary Shaw's control is fantastic, and you've got Morley's exuberance. It looks like Villa are the most exciting team in the world, but it's that once you've got it organised and solidified defensively, then you can express yourself at the other end.
Because Ron came over as a bit of a dour character in press interviews. I mean, let's face it, that's how most of us feel that we know Ron, isn't it? That's the only, unless you know him as a friend or a neighbour or anything like that, that's the only, it's like now, isn't it? That's the only sighting of a player or a manager you get. So that was the image Ron gave off. And people thought, well, Ron's dour and his team's a dour. But really, that wasn't the case. They were hard working, like you said. They were all very physically fit. Ron trained them really hard in pre-seasons. But like you said, when they had the ball, they broke forward with pace. Doing research for the book, I was looking at YouTube videos and I couldn't stop watching some of them. The way the likes of Gibbo, Williams and Swain burst forward and from the fullback positions, it was so exciting to watch.
And this is, you know, when anybody looks at how Pep Guardiola builds his teams, the two fullbacks are essential. They've got to be able to play forward.
Get forward, but get back.
And he'll spend good money on them. And you look at Villa, they had exactly that. And that was, if there's one thing that Villa have struggled, especially in the last 10 years or so, is having decent fullbacks. I mean, under Martin O'Neill, we have a right back for about 5 seasons. And then now we've got about 10 right backs and no left back.
Yeah, that's true. I think Alan Hutton's I think he's grown into the club really well. I think he's become one of our most consistent players, whether he's at right back or left back. I think he would compare favourably to one of those players we had back then. But like you say, we're missing the left back or the right back, whatever
Hudson,
position
I don't
he
think
is.
Has, let's say, the finesse in the final third. I mean, sometimes he'll...
At least he's a proper defender, and he does like to get forward. I don't mind that. At least there's a bit of attacking intent. When you compare him to someone like who was that guy we had who played at left back? I lost his name now.
Nick Story.
No, the old Liverpool player.
Warnock.
No.
Staunton.
No, I'm thinking more of Sissoko. That's him.
Oh, right, yeah.
I felt he had a nosebleed if he crossed the halfway line. He was so negative. Maybe that's the way some managers asked him to play. But at least Hutton does have that attacking intent. So I actually think McGinn is like a Dennis Mortimer there, and I don't make comparisons like that very easily. I think McGinn has that ability to get forward and score goals, but also he gets back as well and tackles.
Well, he's a player that Ron Saunders would potentially sign.
Yeah, not a big name, and in today's market, you know, 2.75 I think it was is a snip, isn't it? Back then, he would probably. Compared to the old £200,000 signing.
He's an example of the kind of signings Villa will be making from now on in, because you do a bit of due diligence, get a good price, and you can actually, if he leaves in the end, because Villa haven't been making profits on any of these players.
No. Been giving them away because they were overpaying, wasn't they, on a lot of the players?
Yeah. And they're overpaying on wages chronically on your, you know, the likes of Hogan and Lansbury and Elphick.
There's a lot of squad players sitting on the bench that if you were a new manager coming in, you'd really want to start trimming the squad a bit, wouldn't you? And sort of getting rid of these players who are on big wages not playing and bringing in some of your own men. But it's not easy, is it, to sell players who are quite happy sitting on a big contract and no other teams really want them, which is why you end up giving them away. You just want them off the wage bill.
Did you learn anything new about the Saunders and Ellis relationship? Because obviously, I think Ellis says in the book, and I forgot to ask you about Ellis, Ellis says in the book they're obviously not on each other's Christmas card list. So how was the interview going to Ellis? Because I'd imagine, was he a bit suspicious about it in the first?
Probably.
When he was first approached?
He let me into his house for 2 hours, and he spent the first hour telling me about everything good he'd done for the club, which is fair enough, and you have to give him his time, don't you, Doug, when you're in his house, and he is Mr. Aston Villa, whatever mistakes he's made. It was very courteous and respectful, but
fine china.
I'm sure there was, but I was more interested on these 52 questions I wanted to ask him, but I managed to get about 48 in the end. But what I would say is that I had a lot of difficult questions. I knew that would probably be my only chance to ask all these difficult questions to Doug, and I asked most of them, and what I would say was he started looking at his watch when a lot more of the challenging pressing questions came, and I was politely shown the door after about 2 hours because it was lunchtime. But I think
that's alright, Doug, I'll join you.
I wasn't that cheeky, but I would actually, without blowing my own trumpet, I think he was impressed with the research I'd done and the interviews I'd done by then.
What stage was that interview? If you're talking about 4 years to put it together.
I think I interviewed him in 2014, which would have been probably about a year in. But I'd spoken to a lot of people by then. And it was, I mean, the main things I was keen to know about Doug were a lot of the sales, really, after the European Cup. And the one thing that came from him was he said, I'd never told a manager who to sell or who to buy. He said that was always down to the manager. Some players would probably say that's a load of rubbish.
I did put that question to Graham Turner,
and he said, no, everyone I sold or bought was my decision, it wasn't Doug.
Because there was the infamous rumour that he bought David Janella
obviously
for Gregory.
That may well have been true. That's come a lot after the book period. I'm not sure about that, but all I can say is in the period I was concentrated on, Doug said that he let the managers make those decisions on transfers. What I would think definitely happened, though, he would have put people like Tony Barton and Graham Turner under pressure by saying, look, if you want this player, you're going to have to generate £500,000 first from selling players. He was certainly always had a keen eye on the balance sheet and knew that you can't just keep buying players, you've got to sell to buy, which is probably the one criticism I personally would have for him, that where Villa lacked a bit of ambition, where they just didn't go that extra mile and add to what we've got.
That's a phrase that's been used
too many times.
But it was being used in the mid-90s when the likes of Southgate, Ekiog and George Boateng were saying, why did you leave Villa? Lack of ambition, and they ended up at Middlesbrough.
And then even after Doug's time with Randy Lerner with the Martin O'Neill days, it's a shame, isn't it? It is a recurring pattern. It's a bit of a blot on Villa's copybook, really.
And did Ellis have any regrets? Did he?
Well,
from your time with him.
Regrets. I mean, I asked him about the relegation. Of course, that would have been a regret he would never have wanted. But he said he felt that pain more than anybody.
Because Graham Taylor described the club as a shambles.
Probably wasn't more the club as a shambles. I would have thought the club, knowing Doug, was in reasonably good state financially. I think the team was in more of a shambles.
Yeah.
So when he came in, he knew a lot of players had to go, and he wanted to bring in a lot of other players because, I suppose, like the situation we're in now, you need a certain kind of character to roll up your sleeves when you're in the second tier. Some players think they're too good for that, don't they? And Graham Taylor made massive changes, sold about 11 players and brought in about 11 players. So he was strong enough also to stand up to Doug and said, well, if you want promotion, we're going to have to pay this player this amount of money wages, or we're going to have to spend this. A lot of his transfer fees wasn't that big, actually. Graham Taylor, he was buying people like David Hunt, Stuart Gray, Steve Sims, you know, a lot of these players, just people he knew he could trust to do
the
job he
wanted. They were like around 100,000 mark, weren't they? I think Andy Gray and Stuart Gray were essential purchases. They kind of changed.
They made
Villa a bit, let's say, tougher.
There was Mark Lillis again. People who, as a Villa fan, you'd never say, oh, let's go out and sign Mark Lillis. You know, he would have been the last name that most of us would have thought of. But, you know, he did a job in that promotion team. Added to some of the players we already had, someone like Gary Thompson, who, a Villa fan as a kid, Brummie guy, knew what it meant, rolled up his sleeves, and one of our key players in that promotion year, along with guys that were still there like Alan Evans. So
there's a chapter on the book, in the book, sorry, all about Gary Thompson's hernia, if you're interested.
Well, why that was relevant was because I think it showed he kept breaking down in the relegation year.
But it is an insight into sometimes that clubs don't do their job.
It just showed that Villa was unable to identify his injury
Well, when Graham Taylor came in, within not long, that injury was diagnosed as a hernia, and he got sorted out. So straight away,
yeah,
it just went a bit deeper than the team. It was even like the support staff. Graham Taylor brought his own medical staff in, and Tomo got sorted. So it's just another example how Graham Taylor improved things.
If I have three regrets, or three key moments in my time of supporting Villa that I look back on, I remember being sad about. One was Ron Saunders leaving, which obviously is well covered in the book. The second was Graham Taylor getting the England job, because I thought Villa were onto a good thing at that time. But the other thing is Gary Shaw's injury, and I haven't read that section of the book. Is it covered in the book? Because
yes,
I think
yes,
that is something that
contributes
to the fall of the European champion.
Yeah. Well, Steve McMahon made a good point actually when I interviewed him. He said that when he came in, he was actually excited. He said he turned down Liverpool to come to Villa, and the cynical people would say you only did that because you can't go from Everton to Liverpool. So it was, Villa was a very handy stepping stone. The cynical people would say that, but he denied that and said, no, I genuinely saw Villa as a great move. You know, they'd won the European Cup a year before, and I saw them as a big move. So whatever your thoughts on that, McMahon made a good point with that. Villa's slide was partially down to some really terrible luck with Gary Shaw's injury that you just mentioned, also Gordon Cameron's breaking his leg.
Yeah.
He said that you can't
took a season out.
Yeah, so. He said you can't overestimate the blow that was on Villa. There were two players really who, he says, Gary Shaw would have had a lot of caps for England, and Gordon Cameron's probably would have had a lot more, because that broken leg came at a terrible time for him where he was in the England squad.
Yeah.
Villa was obviously doing well. So to take Shaw and Cairns out of that squad, yeah, that was a real double hammer blow.
So, I mean, how does Gary Shaw carry it on his shoulders? Bears the weight of that? What could have been, or is he pretty philosophical about it?
I think he's probably had so long now to...
Yeah.
He probably gets bored of talking about his knees and his surgeries.
Yeah.
I mean, he's had well over 10 operations on his knees. He's still struggling with it now. His whole career is just a terrible, sad case, isn't it, of what might have been.
Yeah.
I think Colin Gibson said that if it hadn't been for injury, we'd have been talking about Gary Shaw in the same breath as people like Bergkamp and Van Basten.
Yeah, no, without
and,
a doubt. Yeah.
And even Ray Wilkins, when I interviewed him, he said that what a great player he was. You know, he says he wasn't just a good... He trained with him for England. He says he was a fantastic player. You know, so it's a very sad case really, and that was just one of the things that really contributed to Villa's slide after Rotterdam.
Have you got any closing words?
Oh, just for any, I mean, obviously I'm not going to demand people go out and buy the book. What I would just say is that if anyone has got interest in Aston Villa, and particularly that period of 1970s and 80s where we came up, we conquered Europe and then slid back down again, if anybody really is interested in knowing what went on behind the scenes, in the boardroom, in the dressing room, on the training ground, if anybody's interested in knowing all the stories behind the stories, then I'd like to think they're never going to get a better read than this one, because of the so many people I've spoken to, and
well,
it's authentic,
that's
for sure.
That's the key, I mean, because these people won't be around, you know, forever, and it is... The key to any good book is to obviously speak to the people that were actually there, and that's the great thing about it.
You're going to get biographies and autobiographies about one man, whether it's Brian Little's book, Peter Wiv's book, or someone else, Kenny Swain's book. That'll all be about one man.
Yeah.
This book's going to be about the whole club, with all those people being part of the journey. So if you want to know why Villa sold Gidman and Gray, or why the European dream suddenly was shattered very quickly, and how Graham Turner came to be player manager at 36. You know, all these things, they're all covered in there. So hopefully, if people do read it, I'm sure they'll enjoy it if they're, you know, if they've got a passion about Villa.
And when's your next book about Dr. Venglos coming out?
You've been mischievous now.
That's the one I'm waiting for.
Yeah. You know, this has been such hard work, getting to the bottom of all these stories with Villa, that I'm just going to take a breather, I think, and... let my wife get to know me again, and my son, maybe throw a few balls to him and cricket in the back garden again. But
I'm sure there will be another book again in another year or two.
Was it, the actual process in terms of writing it, was it some kind of a structured job? Are you a morning person?
No,
person?
Totally no structure. I would love structure. I think I'm probably someone with OCDs, but I haven't got structure. I have another job that running this agency that you mentioned about, is cricket agency. So I was, it's this book actually, as stressful as it sounds with all the interviews, it was actually quite relaxing for me. It's been a journalist over 25 years. It was relaxing sitting in an airport for 2 or 3 hours. Transcribing interviews and putting chapters together, it was really enjoyable to put together like a jigsaw puzzle, really. So to see it all in print now, and people come up to me and say how much they've enjoyed it, you know, it's very satisfying.
Well, thanks very much for joining me to discuss Ticket to the Moon.
Well, thanks firstly for talking about the book and everything else. I appreciate it.
Just one thing, in terms of Villa history, before this period, we'd hardly won anything when we've had a manager, because when we won all those league titles back, like, I don't know, 19th century, right at the start, turn of the century, teams were picked by committee. So the concept for the manager only really came in, I think it was the 1930s, 1920s, 30s, and Villa resisted the whole idea of having a manager. So when you look back on who won what as a Villa manager, it starts really in the period of this book.
Well, I think so, and I think anybody can quite rightly call this the golden era of Aston Villa, really. Yeah. Obviously, the European Cup is unprecedented in terms of success. But the point I made when Villa won the league, that championship-winning season, that was their first championship win in 71 years, way back since 1910. Yes, Villa has this great history of all these FA Cups and league championships, but even most of our granddads weren't born when a lot of our success. So it just put in perspective, really, that this success came in the more, what I would still call the modern era. You know, 71 years was... ridiculous, really, that it went so long to win the league. So no, I don't think anyone would argue this is the golden era of the club,
the golden generation.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
My old man said,
I guess there's not much we can say in a pub, is there?
Excuse me. Sorry to interrupt. We're recording a podcast. Is there any way... how long are you going to be around?
A few hours.
It's just a bit of background noise.
Is that all right?
Yes. Thank you.
Sorry about that. We found the quietest point and we were like, yes, and then it's like, oh shit.
Sorry, girls.
Don't worry about it.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you. If you don't ask, you don't get.
Well done, you.
Away days are great, but there's nothing quite like playing at home. The same goes for McDonald's. Maximise your home ground advantage with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app. At participating restaurants, 18 plus, serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
And there it is. That's as good as it gets on this stage. Nissan Townstar EV strikes again. It's an unstoppable van. Unstoppable!
Look, just fantastic. You can actually see the ProPilot technology in action. Effortless parallel parking.
It moves with all the confidence that comes with a 5-year warranty.
And with a bench full of all-star van experts, there's real strength in depth here.
That's all-star quality.
Search Nissan Townstar EV and visit your local all-star van centre to see for yourself.
Terms and conditions apply. 5 years or 100,000 miles, whichever comes first.
ProPilot is an advanced driver assist technology. Driver's responsibility to stay alert, drive safely, and control vehicle at all times.
This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network.
TalkSport. Powered by fans.